You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I was going to do this last night and tell you quite frankly, I forgot about it. And don't worry, we're not through. We're not finished by a long sight with the series that I am conducting, but I've just got to read you this. You've got to hear it. Every word of it is the truth. It is so right on, and it confirms everything that I've been telling you for many, many years. It's not written by me. It's called Why Some of Us Fear Clinton by J.R. Nyquist. And it was published Thursday, July 22nd in World Net Daily News. So listen carefully. I think everybody listening needs to hear this. You need confirmation of things from other sources than just me. And then you have to always investigate and discover whether or not we're telling you the truth. And if you don't do that, you'll never know. Well, here goes. Why Some of Us Fear Clinton by J.R. Nyquist. WorldNet Daily News, Thursday, July 22nd, 1999. The Bible teaches us to love our enemies and to hate no one. Now, this is a very noble way to live, though few of us attain such grace. Perhaps the reason so few of us can love our enemies has to do with the link between hate and fear. If someone makes us afraid, we eventually come to hate that person, and however brave some of us are, fear sometimes gets the better of us. It has sometimes been remarked that the so-called far right is irrational in its hatred of Bill Clinton. Many liberal media types think the impeachment of President Clinton was a mean-spirited, hate-inspired attack on a poor, poor, sick guy who suffers from a sexual addiction. Some leftists are especially baffled because they don't see anything special about Clinton that is particularly threatening or dangerous. Well, it's time someone explained the right's fear of Bill Clinton. For if any of us hate Bill Clinton, and certainly we shouldn't hate anyone, as the Bible says, it is fear at bottom that inspires us. This is not a proud acknowledgement, but an honest one. Some of us really do fear Clinton. We experience his term in office as a dangerous time, as a time in which American institutions are exposed to corruption and degradation. It is a time when freedom is imperiled at home and national security is weakened abroad. I can hear my friends on the left chuckling at all this. Such nonsense, they say to themselves. Such right-wing paranoia. But wait. Stop. Let me explain, by way of comparison, where the so-called extreme right is coming from. What if you were Jewish? Imagine how you would feel if America elected a president who, as a college student, had worked for a Nazi front organization, then made a trip to Hitler's Berlin, about which he is not very forthcoming. Imagine also that he married someone with ties to numerous anti-Semitic organizations, someone who idolizes Mussolini and Franco. If you were Jewish, how would you feel? I first heard of Bill Clinton 16 years ago. Here's how it happened. I was getting a teaching credential, and one of my classes was on adolescent psychology. The professor in this course, who was a very admirable teacher, seemed to favor me. One day, after class, she invited me to a 7 p.m. meeting at the science lecture hall. And at the time, I did not know she was a Marxist, and I didn't know the meeting would be political. She said that if I cared about education in the state of California, I would attend. Having the night off from work, I decided on going, partly owing to curiosity. Well, I couldn't have been more surprised if it had been a coven of witches. Arriving early at the science lecture hall, I found communist literature, books and pamphlets stacked on tables in the lobby. A visiting professor was the speaker. He gave a rousing talk on overthrowing the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie in America. How would this be accomplished? By taking over the Democratic Party through its left wing. The speaker said it was possible to elect a stealth socialist president who would effect a peaceful transition to socialism during the next great economic downturn. Capitalism would be unmasked as a bankrupt system. The people would then support a new socialist system. All businesses would be nationalized by the government and run like the post office. This socialist president, said the speaker, could be elected in either 1988 or 1992. The only problem was that of timing. When would the next major economic downturn hit? Some days later, I went to visit my professor at her office hours. We talked about the speaker and the book he had written. We talked about Marxism and the idea of changing the system. And then suddenly my professor said, "We have such high hopes for this young Arkansas governor, Bill Clinton." That was the first time I heard Bill Clinton's name. But it wasn't the first time I'd heard this idea of taking over the left wing of the Democratic Party and electing a stealth socialist president. I'd first heard that idea in 1981 when I was a senior at the University of California. The left-wing activist Derek Shearer came to speak on the subject of economic democracy. Two radical friends of mine dragged me to hear him, though I had my heart set on a game of chess that day. So I went to listen to Shearer's talk, and I sat there in the front row, concentrating on his theory of economic democracy, thinking to myself, this is just like Marxism. After Shearer finished speaking, I went up and asked him point blank, "Mr. Shearer, what is the difference between Marxism and economic democracy?" He looked at me a bit suspiciously for a second, and then he said, "I probably shouldn't say this, but there is no difference." I had a long discussion with Shearer about why he wasn't a forthright Marxist. He said that Marxism was unpopular with the American people, who have a knee-jerk negative reaction to words like socialism and communism, even though, according to Shearer, these are perfectly good words. Therefore, in order to win Americans over to socialist ways of thinking, you need to create a new euphemistic language. A kind of linguistic deception. Scheer also talked about taking over the Democratic Party through its left wing and electing a stealth socialist president. As it happens, Derek Scheer is a friend of Bill Clinton. Again, think if you were Jewish and the American president and first lady flirted with Nazism and had friends who were anti-Semites. Ah, but the Nazis were mass murderers. It is wrong to compare them with Marxists. Oh, how our leftist friends forget that tens of millions of conservatives, traditionalists, nationalists, Christians, and others have been persecuted, murdered, and driven into concentration camps by Marxists. Nearly a third of the nation of Cambodia was killed by Marxists. The killing continues today. In Rwanda, in Angola, Mozambique, Colombia, and the Congo. Let us be perfectly honest. The historical record is indisputable. Marxism means the persecution of Christians, the execution of right-wing dissidents, massive slave labor camps, and grinding poverty for countless millions of terrified, muzzled human beings. So when it happens that we compare Marxism to Nazism, we are not being unfair in our comparison. We are being historically accurate. We are describing what has happened to conservatives and Christians in country after country. We are talking about mass murder performed by Marxist socialists. What the left has to finally acknowledge is that the ideas of Marx and Lenin, Trotsky and Mao, are as threatening and evil to some of us as the anti-Semitic ideas of Hitler are to Jewish people. And if you look in the Guinness Book of World Records, you will not find Hitler listed as the world's number one mass murderer. No. No, you will not. That distinction belongs to Chairman Mao Zedong. And after Mao, the next greatest mass murderer happens to be Joseph Stalin. Marxist ideologues have killed over 100 million innocent people in the 20th century. The Nazis only killed a small fraction of that. Nobody on the right in this country is going to defend Nazi associations. If a Republican candidate for president was involved with anti-Semites, racists, or worked for Nazi front organizations, he would be denounced. First and foremost, by other Republicans and conservatives. So why is it then that the Democratic Party is soft on Marxism? Why does it tolerate so many fellow travelers and disciples of the hard left? Come now, let us confront this double standard in American politics. It is doubly ironic, therefore, that the left constantly refers to the, quote, extreme right wing, end quote. But this is unfair, because the conservatives in this country do not tolerate the totalitarian right. On the other hand, the liberals in this country have always been soft on the totalitarian left. And that's why many of us fear Bill and Hillary Clinton. Many of us see through the phony centrism of President Clinton. We know what his ideological commitments have been, and we know who his wife is. Does anyone remember that Hillary Clinton arranged to give $15,000 to the National Lawyers Guild, an organization founded in the 1930s as a branch of the Communist Party, USA, when she chaired the New World Foundation? New World Foundation? Does anybody deny her assistance to various Marxist-inspired causes, from the Black Panthers to the Christic Institute and CISPES, a front for Central American Marxist terrorists who have murdered tens of thousands of innocent peasants? Bill Clinton was not merely a draft evader during the Vietnam War. The truth is, he was for the Viet Cong terrorists. And that is why he went to Moscow and Prague almost 30 years ago. That is why he married the young radical Hillary Clinton. And that is why he was friends with Derek Shearer. It also explains why my professor of 16 years ago, who was a Marxist, had such high hopes for that young governor, Bill Clinton. 7 months ago, an intelligence professional whose credentials are impeccable told me something quite alarming. He told of a taped conversation between two Czech communist officials. They were discussing a young American college student, Bill Clinton, who was then visiting Prague. They mentioned that he was expected to attend a meeting at a certain place which was reserved for the recruitment of communist bloc agents. Well, where is this tape now? I asked. Nobody seems to know, he answered. In February, there was another curious incident involving a retired CIA official. This particular fellow was genuinely alarmed at information he had on President Clinton's ties to the Russian security services. When pressed by a famous journalist to provide details, the CIA man shrank away. You see, publicity is death to people involved in secret intelligence work. And now, more recently, I have received information from a third source inside U.S. intelligence. His story is even more fantastic. It is so fantastic that I dare not repeat what he reported. Naturally, everyone on the political left and in the center will denounce the very idea that the president has secret Marxist sympathies that have compromised him. Some would say that repeating such rumors is irresponsible. But there comes a point in time when it becomes irresponsible and dishonest not to say what we are feeling and thinking, and to withhold the reasons that we fear a certain world leader. I did not invent the rumors which are circulating within the intelligence community. Anyone connected with the intelligence community has probably heard these rumors. And people will either dismiss them or take them seriously, depending upon their political point of view. What I want to say to the moderates who are shocked at these rumors, and to the leftists who fear a vast right-wing conspiracy, is simple. Try to put yourselves in our shoes. Be a little sympathetic. Try to understand why we fear Bill and Hillary Clinton. These fears are not irrational, but entirely understandable. And when we discover that the White House has used the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, to persecute those of us who disagree with him and fear his vague Marxist background, then we are confirmed in our fears. We are confirmed in our fears. The unscrupulous use of power to suppress dissent is the beginning of dictatorship. It is this sort of behavior that we all found intolerable in the presidency of Richard Nixon. And we did not defend him when the facts became clear. In that event, the Republican Party itself turned against Nixon. But the Democrats do not follow the Republican example. No matter what abuse of power or malfeasance of office, the Democrats support the president. It makes us afraid of the Democratic Party itself. What has happened to it? Is it becoming like one of those totalitarian political parties that supports the leader, the boss, no matter what law he breaks? Certainly, it is wrong to hate the president, but it is nonetheless correct to demand an accounting for his Marxist past, his corrupt administration, and his abuse of power. Suspecting Bill Clinton of Marxist sympathies should not be a crime. It is not a crazy speculation, but only natural for those of us who have studied his career and his associations. And if the country continues to evade the issue of the president's Marxist connections because any such inquiry is somehow McCarthyist, then the country might as well admit to an area of de facto censorship. We have reasons to fear the Clintons, and these reasons deserve consideration.
Boss, and bring me that girl and her dog. Do what you like to the others, but I want her alive and unharmed. They'll give you no trouble, I promise you that. And send them an insect on the head to take the fight out. Take better care of those ruby zippers. I want those most of all. Now die! Die!
You all over.
They sure knocked the stuffing out of you, didn't they?
Don't stand there talking. Put me together. We've got to find Dorothy.
What's a nice little dog. And you, my dear. What an unexpected insist. It's so kind of you to visit me in my loneliness. All in good time.
Oh, please give me back my dog.
Certainly. When you give me those zippers.
But the good witch of the north told me not to.
Very well. Throw that basket in the river and drown it.
No. You can have your own slippers, but give me back Toto.
That's the good little girl. I knew you'd see reason.
Can I still have my dog?
No, fool that I am. I should remember. Those zippers will never come off as long as you're alive. But that's not what worries me. It's how to do it. These things must be done delicately, or you hurt the staff.
Look, there's Toto. Where did he come from? Why? Don't you see? He's coming to take us to Dorothy. Come on, fella.
I hope my strength holds out.
I hope your tail holds out.
Oh. Well, will they find Dorothy? We'll discover that later at the end of the broadcast. Think about your income tax, ladies and gentlemen. Think about the information that you hand over willingly that could someday be used to convict you in a court of law.
Oh, but I haven't violated any law.
Little do you know. If you think your income tax information is confidential, you have another think coming. And you'd better think again. You see, the rules enable the IRS to hire outside contractors to process tax return information. A lot of people see your information that you don't even know about. People who don't know you don't care about you. The new rules state that providing tax return information to outside companies does not violate taxpayer confidentiality. Common sense says that anyone other than the IRS who has access to your tax return has the ability to do whatever they want with them. And if you're really smart and you've studied the law, you haven't got any business giving the IRS any information whatsoever to begin with. And this is why they're no longer confidential. In addition, laws force you to expose your every financial detail to any litigant, creditor, tax collector, ex-spouse, prospective heir, competitor, or any other curiosity seeker. Even though your assets may never be threatened, ladies and gentlemen, you better understand that in this country today, your personal affairs and your personal finances or an open book. I told you in a previous broadcast, you would be absolutely amazed. It would shock you. In fact, it would terrify you to know how much information I could get on every single one of you listening to this broadcast, or any one of you, at any time I want to, simply by spending about an hour on my computer. You see, ladies and gentlemen, confidentiality in the United States is virtually non-existent. And all of you helped bring about this state of affairs by constantly and always giving anybody that asked for it whatever information they asked for, by filling out surveys and warranty cards and, well, you name it. You've answered the questions and you filled them out. Many of you listening to this broadcast have submitted to questions being asked by somebody you didn't know, had no idea who they were. They just called you on the telephone and told you they were conducting a survey and began to ask personal questions about you, your income, your family, your home, your children, your occupation. And, oh, little sheeple you just answered all those questions without even any way at all to even tell who the person on the other end of the phone line really was. Now that you've heard me say that, I know you've got one hand up against your cheek and you're saying, oh, why did I do that? Why indeed? Why did you do it? Why would you ever do such a silly thing? Stupid, if you really want to know the truth. And then there's you and your bank. You and your bank Did you ever read the fine print on the signature card your bank gets you to sign when you open an account? Well, of course not. Why in the world would you ever want to read the fine print? The contract which you are signing and committing yourself to. Why would you want to read that? Silly you. It reads, in part, and I quote, "The undersigned hereby agrees to abide by all the rules of the bank," end quote. Did you ever see those rules? Do you know what the rules say? What have you actually done, or what you have actually done? Well, it won't come together completely for several more episodes of the Hour of the Time, but at least you'll begin to get an inkling of what we're talking about here. An international business corporation known as an IBC with a private offshore bank account. The government then knows nothing of your banking business, and as demonstrated in previous broadcasts and will again be demonstrated in future broadcasts, the IRS, the government, your creditors have no way to find out. Now, doesn't that sound like a better arrangement to you? And did you know that your bank operates as a snoop for the government? In fact, you could say that everybody who sits in a bank and works in a bank are G-men, just like FBI agents. This obligation to federal authorities includes all of the bank's employees becoming the on-site, frontline eyes and ears of the federal bureaucracy, backed up by the force of the law. You see, they use powers of the Bank Secrecy Act. For instance, the government imposed regulations on 23,000 banks and depository institutions, including all foreign bank branches in the United States. And similar rules will be imposed on all other financial institutions at a future date. You can be sure of that. Revolutionary in character, these broad rules force bank officers and employees to act as police, imposing on them a legal duty to notify the government via a suspicious activity report, or SRA. You didn't even know they had that, did you? A suspicious activity report, known as an SRA, of any individual or cumulative transaction of $5,000 or more, cash, wire, or otherwise, which in that individual's subjective judgment has no business or apparent lawful purpose or is not the sort in which the particular customer is expected to engage, and the bank knows of no reasonable explanation for the transaction after examining the available facts, including the background and purpose of the transaction. See, you didn't know your banker was spying on you, did you? And you didn't know that if you complete any kind of a transaction that cumulatively amounts to $5,000, there's going to be a suspicious activity report filed by your bank on you. All of you should learn to secure your assets. I'm going to be concentrating a lot of effort to teaching you that. How about your Social Security number? Do you think that's confidential? No. See, if I have your name, I can go on my computer and get your Social Security number in a matter of seconds. Not an hour, seconds. In fact, You'd be surprised at how much information I can get on you in just a few seconds if I just know your name. And if I don't know your name, all I need is your telephone number. If I know your telephone number, I can not only get your name, but your address and where you work. I can get your Social Security number. I can get your entire life's history, as a matter of fact, over a very short period of time. And so the answer is no. Your Social Security number is the most frequently requested identification number used in America today, and right on the Social Security card that they give you, it says not to be used for identification. So why do you silly sheeple continue to give it out freely anytime anybody that has no business even knowing it asks you for it? Aren't you beginning to feel a little silly? Well, you should. You see, we didn't get to this point in time because we're all so smart. We got here because we're particularly ignorant and, yes, even downright stupid in a lot of our behavior over the past 100 years or so. We've asked for it, and now we're getting it. You see, initially, Social Security numbers were used for only one purpose, to keep track of Social Security benefits. In the law, it says it could not be used for any other purpose. On your Social Security card, it says not to be used for identification. And then all of a sudden, it was used to keep track of federal tax information. And then employers wanted to know your Social Security number, but they don't have anything to do with the Social Security Administration. And then all of a sudden, the United States Armed Forces changed from serial numbers to using the Social Security number. And the rest is history. Now you walk in a store to buy anything on credit, and the first thing they ask you for is your Social Security number. They ask you for it even if you want to lay something away. The first thing a police officer will ask you for, what's your Social Security number? Right after he asks you for your driver's license. Over the past decade, there has been an explosion of information available through sophisticated computer databases, and you would just be absolutely amazed at what's in those databases about you. And it didn't take long for other sources to realize that using your Social Security number would be an easy way to identify you and keep track of information about you. Banks, credit card companies, landlords, doctors, dentists, insurance companies, lenders, employers, schools, and credit bureaus, almost always required as a condition of service. I went to a doctor, told him I was going to pay cash that day for my visit. And they wouldn't even treat me, even though I was going to pay cash, without a Social Security number. I asked them, what do you need my Social Security number for? I'm going to pay you cash. You don't have to track me down for payments or anything like that. Oh, our whole medical records system is by Social Security number. And so because they could not make a record that would fit into their system by Social Security number, they wouldn't even treat me. And it was okay with me because I wasn't going to give them my Social Security number no matter what. That was a long time ago. Through decades, ladies and gentlemen, of blind and unquestioned cooperation, most Americans have freely and voluntarily given up their rights to privacy by automatically giving out their Social Security number and any other kind of information that anybody has ever asked them to anyone, literally anyone who has asked for it. Although it has become commonplace for others to ask for it, it's important to understand that you are not required to give out your Social Security number to any company, individual, or business that does not affect the revenue for your Social Security account. And if you don't believe that, ask Taco Bell. They absolutely refused to hire an applicant that was fully qualified for the position for which he was applying because the applicant would not furnish a Social Security number. The applicant sued Taco Bell. Taco Bell ended up paying that applicant millions of dollars in settlement and penalties and punitive damages. And now if you go to apply for a job at Taco Bell, on the application it says Social Security number, and then in parentheses it says not required. They learned their lesson. But I still get people calling me every day saying, they won't hire me. I can't work unless I give them my Social Security number, and I don't want to give it to them. I said, well, don't give it to them. But then they won't hire me. I said, then sue them. Well, I don't have the money to hire a lawyer. I said, well, then what are you calling me for? You wanted answers? I gave you answers. If you're not willing to go through the drill to maintain your freedom, don't call me. I don't have a magic wand. I'm not God. I can't say hocus pocus and make it all go away. You have to do that. But I don't have the time and I don't have the money and I can't hire a lawyer. Children, whining and crying about all of this stuff that they have to do, but not willing to take one step to end it. Children, playing little children's games, cowboys and Indians in the backyard. And, oh, you should hear them cry when they get hurt. Whine. So you don't have to give your Social Security number to anyone. That includes your creditors, credit bureaus, doctors, hospitals, banks, private businesses such as car rental agencies, or anyone else who may want to keep track of you. It's against the law. Under the Privacy Act, Title V of the United States Code, no state or local government agency can deny you any rights, benefits, or privileges if you refuse to provide your Social Security number. The only exception would be any law passed before 1975 that specifically states that you must provide your number to that agency. There's very few of those. The Privacy Act, Title V, clearly states that, and listen to me carefully, it shall be unlawful to deny any individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law because of such individual's refusal to disclose his or her Social Security number. Oh, you say, but I must have a Social Security number to work in the United States. Wrong. Other than the Social Security Administration and the Internal Revenue Service, if you are required to file and pay taxes by law, if you can find that law, I'm interested in seeing it, because neither me or anyone else has ever been able to find such a law, and the Internal Revenue Service cannot produce such a law. There is no law. And so really, the only entity to which you must give a Social Security number to is the entity from which you obtained it, the Social Security Administration. Now, the Internal Revenue Service will say the only other entity you are required to give your Social Security number to is your employer. And they say this is necessary to prepare tax records for the Internal Revenue Service and for the Social Security Administration. They even say that your employer is forbidden by law to divulge your Social Security number to anyone. But there's a problem with that. The problem, number one, is that your employer is not an agent of the United States government. Your employer does not fulfill the law for someone who is authorized to withhold money from your paycheck or request a Social Security number from you. And if you don't believe me, look in the law. You'll find out that's true. In fact, if anybody ever gets the guts to sue their employer over all of this stuff, they're going to be really rich people literally within a couple of years, however long it takes that suit to get through the court, because you're going to win. But even if you want to go along with it and play their silly, stupid game, and even if you don't care about tyranny, even if you don't care about the extortion, and even if it's okay that they take 30-some-odd percent of everything that you make working at your job by the sweat of your brow away from you before you even see it, just about anyone with a computer who has access to your Social Security number can find out your worth. Everything that you've ever purchased on credit, what you've told those people about your income and where you live, and all kinds of stuff, your credit history, your phone number, even if it's unlisted, phone records, U.S. bank accounts, credit card statements, court records, licenses, what groceries you buy, or other information about you that is not supposed to be available, is readily available to anyone. I can get all of it. I can get so much information on you off of a computer in less than an hour that you would be embarrassed and scared to death, amazed, terrified even. And all of this information concerning your private life is available to any individual who has the money to pay for it or the time to go looking, because it's right there. You don't even have to pay. And it gets worse, ladies and gentlemen. As this report was being prepared, we read an article about a new company advertising on the Internet. They provide a service where you can find the name, address, two previous addresses, month and year of birth, telephone number, maiden name, and Social Security number of anyone through their website. Think of what others could do with this information about you. So what's the solution? Well, you can't change the information that's already available, but you can start right now to become invisible. To just disappear and become invisible. And the first step you must take is to get offshore. Now, whether you want to stay here or not, doesn't matter. You better get all your assets offshore. All of them. And you can arrange by having all your assets and your business dealings and everything offshore to literally disappear. Even though you're right there all the time, people can shake your hand and go to dinner with you and all of that kind of stuff. You still go to the bathroom, and, you know, you're still there. But literally, you're invisible to all of those people who wish that you were not. So you think your banking and your credit card records are confidential, but they're not. Remember the fine print on the signature card your bank gets you to sign when you open an account? It reads, "The undersigned hereby agrees to abide by all the rules of the bank." Did you ever ask to see the rules? Of course not. What you've actually done is to agree to abide by all the administrative rules of the Secretary of the Treasury. You signed a contract with the government. Voluntarily waived your right to privacy and agreed to be accountable to the state. And, for all intents and purposes, you have formed a partnership with the government. Now let's talk about the Bank Secrecy Act. It's not what you think. You see, they titled this act aptly, "To Fool the Public." The Bank Secrecy Act? Well, that would make the normal person think that that means bankers have to be secret about your financial information. But that's not what the law is. You see, the Bank Secrecy Act, the name of it, is a misnomer if there ever was one. Contrary to its name, the Bank Secrecy Act wipes out any pretense of privacy. There is no secrecy in a bank concerning your financial business. The United States government has virtually deputized all bankers to enforce federal policies instead of customers' wishes. It compels American banks to record customers' financial transactions and make them available to any individual, company, or government agency with a subpoena. Anyone can subpoena bank records. If they do, every bit of information is available to them. And to make sure of that, your bank must microfilm every check or draft for deposit or collection. Now go down and get the requirements and just look at the new reporting requirements imposed on all facets of business and banking. They include, but are not limited to, cash transaction reporting, cash deposit reporting, cash withdrawal, and cash transfer reporting. The bank must report to the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, every cash transaction of $10,000 or more. If you try to avoid this by cashing a series of smaller checks or making smaller cash deposits under $10,000, you commit another crime called structuring. This cash reporting law, more than any other, encourages people to go offshore. Now, if this is not scary enough, the truth is, they really report transactions as small as $3,000 or more. And if that's not scary enough, the Internal Revenue Service is setting up a computer program that will compel every commercial bank to screen every transaction of daily electronic fund transfers to look for suspicious activity. What the hell are they talking about? You know what suspicious activity is? The IRS is already wired to nearly every bank. Now the FBI has powers to seize records and wiretap without a warrant. And you thought Hitler was bad. I mean, the Gestapo in Nazi Germany had none of these powers. And we all thought that they were the worst, most despicable people in the world, didn't we? Well, they're here, folks, and they're here with a vengeance. Consider your credit card account. Your credit card transactions leave a trace forever to paint an intimate picture of your life for anyone who may be interested. Whether you realize it or not, you write your biography with credit card slips every time you make a purchase. And this is especially true if you buy socially or politically incorrect publications, products, etc. Now you can be sure that credit card lists are routinely purchased by intelligence, tax, and government sources. And while you may have nothing to hide now, maybe someday you will find that this information will be detrimental to your current situation and even to your health. These are just a few reasons to consider an international credit card, a MasterCard or Visa debit or credit card tied into your offshore trust, your offshore IBC, your offshore bank, since offshore banks do not require a social security number or any other identification number, an international credit card will allow you to make purchases, pay bills, and withdraw money from your trust with absolute privacy and confidentiality. And while it may not be practical for most people to get out of the banking system altogether, you can minimize this problem or eliminate it completely by establishing an affordable offshore trust and or an IBC plus an international debit or credit card. The government then knows nothing of your banking business. Isn't that a better arrangement than the one that you are currently in? I think it is. In fact, I know it is. I do it, along with millions of others. Not just a few, but millions. You see, I can tell you all this now. I have nothing to lose. There's a warrant out for my arrest. Eventually, they're going to come up here and kill me. and I'm going to die defending what I believe in right here, my home. I'm not a criminal, so I'm not running anywhere. Annie and the children were not criminals, but I didn't want them to be up here when they come to kill me. And the only reason they issued a warrant for Annie, she's never committed a criminal act in her life, was to get leverage over me. But they didn't know me very well. Doesn't work with me. I'm an honest man. I'm a principled, honest man. I believe in truth. And that's the most dangerous thing in the world to these socialist, communist, puke-faced, Nazi, jack-booted, tyrannical thugs. And so that's what makes me the most dangerous radio host in America. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. God bless you all. Good night, Annie, Pooh, and Allison. I love you. I wish I could tell you a bedtime story just like I used to do. But maybe your mom will do it for me.
Castle of the Wicked Witch. Dorothy's in that altered place.
Oh, I hate to think of her in there. We've got to get her out.
Don't cry now. We haven't got the oil can with us, and you've been squeaking enough as it is.
Who's there? Who's there?
I've got a plan how to get in there.
You got a plan.
And you're going to lead us.
Yeah. Me?
Yes, you.
I got to get around there.
That's right.
All right. I'll go in there for Dorothy. Wicked witch or no wicked witch. Gods or no gods, I'll tear them apart. Huh? I may not come out alive, but I'm going in there. There's only one thing I want you fellows to do.
What's that?
Talk me out of it.
Oh, yeah, all of
them.
Oh, no. 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 Oh, no.
The Wicked Witch is dead.
Hey, hey, Dorothy, the Wicked Witch is dead.
Now we can go back to the wizard and tell him the Wicked Witch is dead.
The Wicked Witch is dead.
four or five courses, let them get in the groove, and then go on into the introduction. I'm cool. I'm cool. I'm cool.
You're listening to 101.1 FM Eager.
6-9. Got me the same as woman. Believe me, this chick's no sense.